The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Let's pretend for a moment evolution is true. And since we're in a pretending mood, let's say that the entirety of the universe and all life as we know it in its myriad and complex forms on this earth all happened by accident. Let's even assume that the sun instantly materialized, that the entirety of the vastness of the universe, and of course they think there may be more than one, so let's add all of the many universes, if there are such, and we're fairly certain there are, all materialized suddenly. And then let's imagine how life crawled out of primeval ooze and evolved into complex million-celled insects and all the life forms you see today. And let's pretend that that all happened accidentally, that from some remote beginning, everything as you see and know it today came to be gradually through natural selection, by resident forces, by completely natural causes, and apart from any intervention from any kind of an outside source whatsoever. You know, that is a fantastic story. You stop to think about all that that entails and all of the tremendous missing links, all the great, vast, broad leaps that such a fantastic evolution would have taken, would have necessitated. And it becomes something that is a little bit doubtful. Now, first, let's understand how an evolutionist explains animals did evolve. Let's understand what evolution begins with and what its beginning tenets are. And then I'm going to ask a question involving the Bible, involving the belief of people in the Bible, involving the book of Genesis and some of the statements in the Bible. Evolutionists explain that primitive animals began to become more complex as the rigors of nature demanded. And so an insect grew more specialized, a fish turned into a bird or an amphibian, or a reptile became a rodent changed into a higher mammal. And of course they think that the whale, for example, crawled out of the sea, slithered around first, then developed legs, stood up, climbed trees maybe, and then became disgusted with it all and wandered back into the ocean, where gradually his organs and the vestigial organs they talk about, but in this case some of the bone structure in the lower abdominal region and toward his tail, are no longer necessary. They can't figure out what those are there, and so they assume that the whale is going in the opposite direction. Now, all of this was supposed to have occurred by natural selection, or survival of the fittest, which it's been called. You've heard these terms. You have read, as most people have, some of the latest clippings in newspapers or some of the scientific journals quoted in newspapers and magazines. You've seen some of the beginnings of the Walt Disney series of the nature studies or other movies which talk about evolution. For that matter, many people have seen what they thought was evolution occurring before their very eyes. I remember one in particular where, in comic-like form, artists actually depicted the age of the dinosaurs coming to a close and all of the structure of prehistory, as it's called, as the evolutionist views it occurring. Now, all of this today is so completely and casually accepted, is so totally part and parcel with modern educational theory, with the entire concept of modern education, that at this point in such universities as Northwestern or Columbia, Yale, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge, you name it, wherever there is a big and up-to-the-moment chic, space-age, modern university, to question such a thing, well, it would be one of the biggest jokes of the day. It really would, and a lot of educators, I think, would say, oh, come on, wasn't all of that question about God's existence solved way back here at this trial where it was all put before the judge and the jury, and I think they would laugh about it. Today, we're living in a sort of a revolution of education, and it's moral, spiritual, theological, as well as educational, because they're saying there is no God, or others are sensationalizing that by saying God is dead, or they're talking about situation ethics, that if you feel like you ought to do it and it appeals to you, that that might be right to you, even though some other segment of society says that it's wrong, and that good is not necessarily good unless it's good for you the way you view it. It's called the new morality. It's called situation ethics. And people are saying there is no such thing as eternal truth. There is no such thing as an absolute. And they're pretty positive about that. As a matter of fact, they say absolutely there are no absolutes. So to postulate that evolution might not be true. and especially to say the book of Genesis, as it was originally written, just as it blatantly states in the first chapter, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, I don't think I need to tell you that would get one of the most derisive hoots and chuckles out of many an educator of about any joke you could tell him. But the question is there still any reason to wonder about evolution? To seriously question this thing of natural selection, survival of the fittest, the idea that all the complexities of life as you know it today gradually evolved down through billions and billions of years, aeons of time, and all as a result of necessity, of a need for animals to survive, for insects and rodents and amphibians and snakes, lizards, every type of creature that you can possibly know, and we haven't even cataloged them all, to develop just as you find him today, by resident forces through natural causes without any kind of divine interference. Certainly these two ideas that are extremes of the pendulum, aren't they? The one that says there absolutely was no God, nothing, that you began with an orderly universe and you had this fantastic universe to begin with, the hydrogen atom, inertia, gravity, all the complexities of everything that is inanimate, the cleavage properties of minerals, the refraction of light, power, force, energy, nuclear energy, fire, lightning, thunders, storms, every chemical substance, every mineral, every natural or raw material that exists today, and every law which works upon all those natural minerals or raw materials existed then. And then finally, as it all sort of shook and sat there and bubbled and stewed in some primeval swamp, a couple of amoeba, apparently representing even the two different sexes, gradually appeared. Now, you've never had a chance to examine all the facts. And, of course, you're not quite sure, but like most people, you feel there are professionals who are paid to worry about these things, just like there are professionals in government, and there are professionals in industry, and there are professionals in all types of fields, and, of course, they're concerned with these things. And maybe since you are not a religious person, and you're not necessarily a collegian, and you're not looking for some great intellectual argument, maybe you leave it to the experts. You're content to see what it says in a scientific journal, and if there is a sensational article about Zinjanthropus africanus or about a discovery in Southern California that seems to push, according to one scientist or another, the known origin of mankind back another 600,000 years, well, what are a few hundred thousand years to evolution? And so, with another casual bite of toast and a gulp of morning coffee, you turn the page to the sports or the comics section and forget about it, and you're pretty certain that the ideas about evolution must be fairly substantiated and could easily be proved. You're going to find that all of that is a fantastic house of cards. And finding it isn't always a pleasant experience, because to find something that has been comfortable and that people have believed in just by casually assuming and taking it for granted for a long time, and to find that all of that is nothing but a tremendous amount of supposition, of beginning with false premises, beginning with absolutely nothing and then making something of it, and then beginning to assume and to postulate and to suppose, to guess, and to feel or to be led to believe based upon a false assumption in the first place, and to have it all come tumbling down like a house of cards could be a pretty traumatic experience. And you begin to envision that ancient world. Did all the animals and insects get together and have a sort of a United Nations to establish what was going to be the balance, a uniform code of behavior by trial and error? You look at the world today, and all about you, except, that is, for the human being, you see balance, harmony, beauty, complexity, interdependability, clearly defined species, life going about in cycles, each acting as a gauge, a governor, and a control on another. Nothing living or dying to itself, everything having, as if it were, a particular niche or part that it plays in a vast, complex, fantastically regulated material world of plant and animal life. But now, if you were to assume that evolution is absolutely true, you have to take into account all the codes of instinct about you, all of these animals and insects and the way they live. And I'm going to get down to specific cases in just a moment. But you would have to realize that there is an established code of instinct. Just like lemmings, they solve their overpopulation problem by conveniently disposing of themselves. Just like the billions of eggs that never hatch when mosquitoes go to lay them. like all of the tremendous potential of rats that they could multiply so fantastically, and yet they never do, unless there is an imbalance in nature temporarily. So did all the animals get together and sort of organize and realize that their own impulses would bring chaos if there were not some kind of completely unified code of behavior? Did the animals and insects legislate it? Well, of course, that's absolutely preposterous and ridiculous. So let's take a look at some of the fantastic examples of animal instinct and then ask yourself, did this come about by trial and error, natural selection? Let's look at evolution this way. Here's a gigantic trunk that says life, and not only life, but beyond life. Life occurred accidentally. It just happened by accident without any outside interference whatsoever. That's the way life began. But let's go beyond life. They say that energy, law, substance, which is matter in all of its intricate, complex forms, and every great law which you know to be utterly dependable, which works upon that matter, all was here. All existed absolutely by accident. That is the trunk of the tree, that it all could have evolved accidentally. Now we'll progress a little bit along that tree and out to a couple of the branches that evolution talks about, of natural selection, of the survival of the fittest, that once you have a beginning animal, which they think is fairly simple to see how life could have come into existence from nothing automatically, but which in truth is anything but simple, is the biggest and the most all-consuming question mark in the evolutionary theory, although there are many, but is casually assumed and tossed aside and taken for granted, and of course embarrasses people who even talk about it. So long a few branches later, are the major, huge questions of instinct and of the fact that there is a definite balance in all these creatures, a code of instinct that makes them in rational behavior act toward, against, or of, or in consideration for each other, so that nature, as we know it, has a fantastic balance. Now, that's quite an order to pretend that all that happened accidentally. But let's just take one other branch of the tree for a moment and look at bird migrations. What makes a bird migrate? Now, we can look at what causes an airplane to navigate, and maybe a lot of you would have a real problem having someone at JPL explain to you about some of the navigation of how some of these satellites can home in on stars or the moon or the sun itself, and how they can be led by little radio beams going out through space. Maybe the Doppler system, vertical omni-range radio or VOR and so on, that aircraft pilots use, that in itself not foolproof. Some of the most marvelous electronic gadgets today that guide our big ships, our jet aircraft, and our satellites around the world, and many times flawlessly and unfailingly, and yet they are susceptible to failure, and yet you never find a duck that loses his way and can't find the way back to the nesting of the homing grounds and can't find the way to the place to spend the winter. So now, taking a look briefly at a bird commuting between two exact points thousands of miles apart on a punch-in, punch-out schedule, science offers many guesses as to how these creatures do this. First, there's the magnetic compass theory. They figure that maybe there's the sort of a built-in magnetic compass that has to do with the Earth and its magnetic field. Then there's the star compass theory, the sun arc theory, the Earth rotation theory, and many others. And they all are theories. Scientists today favor the sun arc theory, and that supposes that the bird calculates the sun's position in reference to the time of the day and the day of the year, and navigates based upon that with a sort of a built-in sextant, that it would plot a perfect course to its destination. But that leaves out a lot of facts, a lot of loopholes. For example, when the sun is not shining, when ducks and geese like to fly. And for example, at night, when so many of them do fly. And for example, the bat, who is blind and must feel or hear, as better said, his way through the air by sonar. He can't see the sun, the stars, or the moon, but he navigates by his own built-in radar, or a kind of a sonar system, actually, because he hears it. Species of bats migrate many miles every year over flat, absolutely desolate, barren land from one area to another. Now, the sun arc theory would be absolutely impossible for birds in short-range migration. Take a homing pigeon, for example. For all practical purposes, within a few square miles, the sun and stars are in the identical position. Yet a pigeon, even blindfolded, can be carried around all kinds of turns, and they've done this to demonstrate it. Blindfolded, spin him around, carry him backwards and forwards and around all kinds of blocks, miles away from home, release him, and he'll beeline right straight for the place from which you took him originally. And he doesn't even need daylight to do it, for that matter. Now, even if scientists found the right theory for each migrating bird, they would only be able to explain what that bird is doing, but still wouldn't be able to explain where it came from. And the fact they're able to hang a label on it and say, well, we think the bird is using this method, does not mean science discovers how the bird does it and what causes the bird to do it. And the migrations of birds are absolutely incredible. Now, you take, for example, the Arctic tern. Each year, that world traveler flies from the Arctic Circle to the Antarctic Circle and back again. You know what kind of a trip that is? That's a 22,000-mile round trip. The tern leaves in late summer before the weather really gets cold. He doesn't even need to, but he does. And the reason is, if he leaves any later, he would arrive at the other pole too late. And instinct would not tell him to leave the place where he is. And how could the sensations or something from another pole, which is completely on the bottom of the earth, tell him he better get there quick before weather conditions close in? And yet this is exactly what occurs. He somehow has that built into him. How did it occur? The very first terns had to do that because they would have frozen to death if they got there too late. They wouldn't have made it. And they had to leave exactly when, even though the climate was still pleasant where they were. Now, spring would nearly be spent and the food supply harder to catch, so he wants to arrive exactly as the snow first thaws and as the food awakens from hibernation and he can eat. How does the tern know exactly when that snow is going to thaw at the opposite pole? It varies every year according to the equinox and the weather cycles, and yet the tern never makes a mistake. He's absolutely correct every time. You're not. You might travel to see Aunt Bessie and it's snowing when you get there. You're not. You step on an airplane as a businessman and you get to some place and you think it's okay and you forgot your overcoat, you'll be all right. You get off and you got to go buy a new one. You can't figure it, but the Arctic tern can. Now, why travel 11,000 miles to the other end of the earth instead of flying just a few hundred miles south where the weather is identical to the opposite pole summer? Why bother doing that? Which tern made the first brave venture into uncharted land? Which one made the first great plunge and went all 22,000 miles distant? And how did the first tern even know there was a pole down there somewhere? As the land gets warmer and warmer toward the equator, why didn't he get disgusted and give up and think, boy, this is getting hot, I'm going to turn around and go back where I came from. I'm an Arctic tern. Don't people know that? But no, you know, even new generations who have never made the trip before always make it perfectly. Fly through all the tropics and head right on down toward the South Pole, and they make it perfectly. They start on time, they arrive on time. Now, how, where, when, why, through what source did the Arctic tern learn all these facts of astronomy, of topography, of meteorology, of geography, of navigation, of the seasons and the rotational patterns of the earth? How and when did that tern get all of that in his little tiny head that has a brain in it no bigger than about half of a little green dinner pea? Kind of amazing, isn't it? You don't have that much intelligence yourself. Now, that's a fact. You would have a real difficult time even figuring all of those factors for yourself. Now, another outstanding migrant is the golden plover that few people know about, and this seabird breeds in Siberia and Alaska, the only breeding grounds, and then leaves for a fashionable winter in Hawaii, which happens to be 2,400 miles of ocean away from home. And here is the amazing thing. The parent birds, after they have laid the eggs, and after the young birds have hatched, take off. And then the young birds, after several weeks, follow the exact path of the parents. Now get this, these birds haven't been taught a thing. The mother bird didn't even stand around very long to cheap a message to them. No schools, no method of flight, no passing on of what one generation learned to the next. They haven't been taught a thing. Yet, invariably, every single generation they follow, just like a little tiny pinprick on a map, something that would be fantastically difficult even for a human being to do with modern charts and maps and modern electronic gear, especially if you hadn't studied it. You would certainly hate to get caught out aboard an ocean liner or perhaps even in a jet aircraft somewhere and have the navigator come back and say, any of you folks ever been to Hawaii before? You know, like the records you may have heard. You would sure hate to have that happen out there with nothing but ocean to go on, wouldn't you? Not the golden plover. The parents left. He doesn't know a thing about it. The birds haven't been taught a thing, but they'll follow the exact route over absolutely featureless ocean to a pinprick island 2,400 miles away. And their parents could not have put the knowledge in their heads. Other birds didn't. Man hasn't, but somebody put the navigational ability there. Monarch butterfly flies up to 1,500 miles every year, often alighting on the very same branch he left. When he returns, a little will-o'-the-wisp that weighs only a fraction of an ounce, fluttering along, often blown in circles by gusts of wind, maybe makes him real dizzy, but he'll plot an exact course from Canada to Mexico and back again to the identical same tree. A little butterfly you could step on and never know you even stepped on him. But he's got fantastic navigational equipment. Now you take a tortoise, he's a marathon at migrations. Every year the Ascension turtle makes a 1,400-mile trip from Brazil to a tiny island in the Atlantic 7 miles long named Ascension, in the Spanish language, or Ascension. And year after year they commute to that same nesting area and often to the same narrow stretch of beach. And their instinct never fails. Fishing boats have caught these great, huge turtles out at sea and carried them hundreds of miles out and then deliberately tried to confuse them and lose them. Or maybe accidentally lost them and had one slip overboard. You know where the turtle shows up? On that same beach, the little island of Ascension, through strange waters it never swam through before. Other turtles transported before birth in an experiment to Ascension will almost immediately swim back to Brazil and finish their span they should have spent there in the first place and then turn around and swim right back to Ascension in the right time of the year. You figure it out. Evolutionists can't. Now, you see how baby turtles know how, where, and when, and in the manner to swim with no training? What does that prove? Turtle IQ? Scientists have tested that theory and found that turtles are very slow of mind. It took one turtle 38 times to walk through a simple maze in a laboratory. He couldn't figure his way out of it. Got lost every time. Yet you stick him in the sea, and he'll find Ascension if you turn him around in circles half of the season before he's due to get there. And that trip is a whole lot more complex than a maze in a laboratory. Now, science cannot explain this contradiction of fact and theory. That turtle migration still, in the words of the National Geographic Society article on it, defies explanation. And even if they could explain it, if they could hang a label on it and say, we think we know how he does it now, remember, all they're doing is trying to tell you a little more about turtles. They're not telling you how the turtle got it. Yet, you know, mankind still seeks and almost seemingly must have a natural physical explanation. He's got to have some kind of a natural explanation for it because he just will not believe there is a God. He will not believe there is a great creator being that made this world and made every bit of life on it for a great purpose. He won't believe a bit of it. But what about natural selection? Can you examine the real facts and find out? You know that according to the Scientific American of May 1965, they were talking about these very turtles, and then they said, by the process of natural selection, I quote their words, this turtle population seems to have evolved the capacity to hold a true course across hundreds of miles of sea using only, we ought to put that word in quotes for them, only animal senses as instruments of navigation. Now wait just a minute, because I'm going to take that statement apart. They said, after what I've just told you, which is factual and can be demonstrated, and I'll prove it to you. If you'd like to corroborate it, of course, you can write for that issue of the National Geographic, or you just go look it up for yourself in the public library about those Ascension turtles to see whether that is true. But this magazine said, by the process of natural selection, this turtle population seems to have evolved that capacity to hold a true course. Let's take the first turtles. They took off, and they kept missing. They kept getting confused, and so they ended up way out at sea, and they couldn't find their way back, and they all drowned. And they all starved to death. And what happened was that even though they could eat fish, and they could live on some type of life found in the sea and swim around in circles thousands and hundreds of miles, tossed by ocean currents, doomed to wander, flipping around endlessly like huge, ungainly paddle wheels in the ocean, yet somehow they managed to survive by eating. All right, let's assume that. But where did they lay their eggs? In the water? They lay their eggs in the water, then what happened? The eggs went down like a rock, or they bobbed around and floated, and birds and fish fed on them, and instead of being protected in the ideal conditions of an exact depth in a certain beach in a certain area of the sea, away from other creatures, the eggs never survived. So, of course, that first generation which evolved, and if that first generation evolved, how could it evolve without the natural, definite, built-in mechanism for doing exactly what these turtles do? In other words, the very first Ascension turtles had to be doing exactly what these do and couldn't have evolved anything. The very first trip had to be absolutely successful, and if it wasn't, the species didn't survive. The first Arctic tern, if it was going to nest one place and spend the summer in another, or the winter, as the case may be, the very first trip had to be a success, or the family of creatures did not survive. And there are many, many more. Countless sea creatures migrate. The squid does. The European eel does. That's a fantastic story all by itself. Freshwater spawners do. Steelhead, salmon, many others. The salmon's example is a fantastic one, returning to identical spawning grounds. Millions of them meeting obstacles every year. They'll climb 50-foot waterfalls and fish ladders, evading hungry bears and eager fishermen, and still get there to the very same gravel bed they left when they were little tiny fingerling, hardly able to swim. You explain it. Science can't. Doesn't even know what kind of a label to hang on it yet, but you know how many hundreds of thousands of golden plovers died in the sea and never made it? How many hundreds of thousands of terns turned around, because they're called terns, you know, and kept turning and turning and turning, and never got to the Arctic where they knew they should be? It is a little bit hilarious, and you can take individual cases in life as you know it around you and then begin to learn a little bit about those creatures, about the way they have absolutely survived, about the miracle of instinct, of camouflage, of preservation, of their ability to eat in the areas in which you find them, of their absolute adaptability, not through evolutionary process at all, but immediately, if they were going to last the first winter, to survive in the area in which you find them. And evolution simply does not give the answer. These animals and insects, birds and fish are perfectly developed, doing perfectly, with no previous knowledge, exactly what they've always been doing, in perfect harmony, in perfect balance, in a vast, intricately arranged, harmonious system to form the entirety of man's environment the way you know it today. You know, in the Bible, in Romans, the first chapter is a challenge that tells you to look to those things which have been made, to the creation, to the universe and the laws that regulate it, to the earth and life upon it, to this vast earth and all the teeming species of life upon it. Take any one of them, take 10 or 20 of them, take just one of them, as I've said, and study it and ask yourself some really objective, plain, and straight-from-the-shoulder questions. Did this happen by accident? Or did it take a divine, all-wise creator being? Laws demand a lawgiver. Life requires a life giver. Order requires someone who ordered it. The complexity, the balance, the harmony required someone to balance and harmonize it all. It all needed a maker. And that's not just a matter of supposition. I can demonstrate that to you if you want to write for these booklets, Does God Exist? And the proof of the Bible, the one on the seven proofs God exists, and the Plain Truth magazine, they're all free of charge. The Plain Truth is not a partisan magazine. It's not a magazine grinding an axe of this or that or the other group. It's not inviting you to join something. But it does make plain and make clear the real meaning of world affairs as you've never seen them before. Also, every number, the Bible Story for Children, letters to the editor, the editorials that have to do with your own personal way of life, right in your own home, your own attitudes, and personal notes on how to overcome, how to grow, how to change, how to really enjoy life in the way it was meant to be enjoyed. And just because you write for it doesn't mean you're obligated. No one's going to call upon you. There's no follow-up. It's absolutely free of charge to you. Your subscription has been paid. That's the Plain Truth, the world's unique magazine, and absolutely without charge to you. So write for it by sending your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Jot down the call letters of your station and then write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.